You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you break free from body shame, binging, and from diets that don't work. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. How amazing would that be? By the way, if you love the show, please take a moment to rate or review it on Apple Podcasts. I would really appreciate your support. And if you would like to join me today, the call-in number is 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. I would love to know what is weighing on you, what is eating at you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. The real problem is what's eating at you. So eating is a solution to the problem. It is not the problem. We want to talk about the problem and find a solution to that. Okay, so something that I hear a lot is, I'm just not good enough. People say, I'm not good enough, or I got this great job, but I somehow fooled them, right? Imposter syndrome. I'm not really good enough to do that, or who do I think I am? I'm just not good enough. And they can't say why. You can't say why you're not good enough. Like, logically, you know you're good enough. Oh, I have to interrupt myself. That Josh is saying, I didn't even know I had an eating disorder. That's right. A lot of people don't think that they have an eating disorder. They think they're food addicts. They think they have no willpower. And yes, examined life. You can ask questions here instead of calling in. Absolutely. I neglected to say that if you are on Instagram, absolutely just drop a, comment in Instagram. What the heck was I saying? Not good enough, right? Not good enough. This is an idea. It is a construct. It is pervasive. So many people don't feel like they're good enough. Intellectually, they know they're good enough. You know you're good enough. And then emotionally, you may feel as if you are not good enough. So there's that conflict between what you know and what you feel. What your mind says one thing, your feelings say another thing. And that is why I often say it is not it's not logical, it is psychological. It is not logical. You know what you know. So what? Who cares? What you know makes very little difference on how you feel and what you do. So how do you get to a point where you can feel good enough? So here are some steps to feeling good enough. Number one, stop comparing yourself to others. Big one, which we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. Number two, recall past achievements. Three, focus on the process rather than the results. Four, talk to someone you love or who loves you. And five, do a random act of kindness. And I'll get to those more later. But first, I want to keep talking about comparison. I started talking about comparison last week. I told you about Zoe, who wanted to join one of my support groups, but she came up with all these excuses. And ultimately, it came down to her feeling of comparing herself to the people that she thought were going to be in the group, and she thought she would be the biggest one there. And this was so horrifying to her that she just wouldn't even go to the group. So to stop comparing yourself to others, which is part of feeling good enough, you got to do two things. You got to look at your relationship with yourself and your relationship with others. And you got to identify your relationship with yourself. Where do the critical thoughts that you have about you, where do they come from? And then you have to look at how your experiences with other people impact your expectations that you're going to be viewed in a certain way. Because if we're judged by other people, we expect to be judged by yet other people. And so the past informs the present. What happened in the past affects what you think you're going to experience in the present or the future. So first, let's look at your relationship with yourself. In Zoe's case, her fear was about being the biggest person in the room. And by the way, let's say you are the biggest person in the room, whether it's an office, a gym, a restaurant, a party, whatever. What then? What do you imagine people are thinking? Is it just a fact? Like, so-and-so has red hair, so-and-so has blonde hair, so-and-so is thin, so-and-so is, you know, bigger. Or is it something shaming? And I asked Zoe, what does she imagine people would think? And she said, they'd think I have no willpower. They'd think I was disgusting and gross, and they wouldn't want to have anything to do with me just by looking at me. Ouch, right? Ugh. I actually get a little sad just thinking about it, you know, that you would feel so certain that people would judge you just based on your appearance. And you know what? What she said, gosh, I am getting all teary. It's so heartbreaking. Let me tell you, that is exactly what Zoe said about herself and to herself. She thought all of those things. She thought that other people would have the same harsh thoughts about her that she had about herself. So unbeknownst to her, she projected her own thoughts about herself out at them and then back at her. Now, most of us are not psychic. I would say none of us are psychic. I'm sorry for the psychics out there, but I have just one question. Why didn't you tell us about coronavirus? If you're psychic, why didn't you tell us about coronavirus and the pandemic? Okay, I digress. We're not psychic. We don't know what other people are thinking. But if you're sure that people are thinking the worst about you, you might want to investigate how you think the worst about yourself. Identifying your self-judgment is the key to building positive self-esteem, because you got to identify the judgment, you got to challenge the judgment, and create a more reasonable and realistic view of yourself. If you see yourself as disgusting and unlikable, you're going to imagine other people will see you as disgusting and unlikable. If you are critical of yourself and judgmental of yourself, not only will you expect that other people will judge you and criticize you, but if you meet someone who is critical and judgmental, you are going to tolerate that because you'll be like, oh, you know me well. This voice is familiar. And you're going to tolerate interaction and behavior and treatment that you ought not to tolerate, because no one should judge you and be critical of you and be mean to you. But if you see yourself as good and likable and approachable and fun and just like a good person to be around, a good friend, then you're going to imagine that other people will feel the same. And if you like you, it's easier for you to imagine other people are going to like you, and it's going to matter less about what other people might think that might be, you know, the judges. So I had a friend from Texas, and one of the things he used to say all the time is, go big or go home. I guess that's a Texas thing. Go big or go home. Do it big or don't do it at all. So go big. Be an emotional heavyweight. Be the person with the biggest self-confidence and the largest sense of self. And I don't mean being, I'm being a little bit, you know, playful with this, but I mean like cultivate a bigger sense of self. Cultivate a sense of goodness about yourself. And well, here's some food for thought to help you with that. Okay? This is what I want you to think about. Where did you get the idea that you're not good enough? Did someone tell you that, either overtly or covertly? Overtly, oh my gosh, I can't believe you messed up again. You're never gonna succeed. You always fail. You always do things wrong. You always mess things up. Right? That's pretty overt. Covert is, I just don't know why you can't, like, you know, do better. Or I just don't know, like, why did these things happen to you? Or, you know, things like that. These are messages that we interpret as, oh, I'm just not good enough. What's wrong with me? Also, what do you think needs to change for you to know or believe that you are good enough? And by the way, what's good enough? What is the standard of good enough? A lot of people say, well, I want to feel good enough. And I'll say, well, how will you know when you feel good enough? I don't know. You got to have a standard of what enoughness is in order to reach it. Josh is saying, when a parent shows us how to be too strict, when a parent shows us how to be too strict to ourselves, we listen. Yes, we internalize the way we are treated. And so that parental voice becomes our voice. And the exam in life is saying, my parents, and I'm in my 40s and still can't get over it at this point, not being able to get over it is what makes me dislike myself. Oh, the examined self, let me tell you, time does not heal all. Time on its own doesn't heal the wounds of the past. In our unconscious, there is no time. We can feel things as strongly today in our 40s or 50s or 60s or 80s or whenever from what happened in the past. Until we heal, we have open wounds within. So if you are getting upset at yourself, disliking yourself, simply because you feel something, that is very unfair to yourself. The people say, well, you're a psychoanalyst. Why is everything about the past? You know what? It's not about the past. It's about how the past is haunting the present. If your parents were cruel to you or critical to you or neglectful to you or hurt you in some way that was either, you know, maybe a little benign and maybe really egregious, it doesn't matter. If you haven't healed that and you have internalized it, then the past is not in the past. It's in your present. And getting mad at yourself because you're not over it. By the way, how do you get over it? How do you get over it? Is it something that you have to literally, you know, jump over? Is it some life hurdle that I don't know about that you just, you know, go over something and then pff, you're done? No, you can't drop it. You can't positive think it away. Time doesn't heal it. You can't stuff it down. You can't starve it away. The only thing you could do to heal is to go through a process of healing, of recognizing how it affected you. Go through, you know, anger, bargaining, depression until you find acceptance. You know, that's how you heal. So examine life. Please do not turn against yourself because you feel a certain way. So you're in your 40s and your parents are still, that you're still upset about your parents. So are a lot of people. Because if you don't heal that wound, like I said, it's going to stay open and raw. But when you heal, kind of like when we cut ourselves, it's an open, raw, bleeding wound. But then it heals, it gets a scab, and then it gets a scar. And the scar is where it used to hurt, but no longer does. Same with emotional wounds. If we don't heal them, they're just hurting all the time. Yes, the exam in life, I'd say if you've been through therapy, but you need to go through it again, you might want to go to a different kind of therapist who's not just talking about the present, but talking about, and not just about the past, but talking about how the past and the present collide and how your present difficulties have their roots in the past so that you can heal. I think that is a great idea. Keep me posted. Let me know how it goes. Okay, so what do you think needs to change for you to feel good enough? How do you heal the past AO, I don't even know. I'm not going to butcher your name. So, person on Instagram, how can you heal? Well, first you have to recognize it. You have to recognize that it happened, and you have to allow yourself to have feelings about it and to say, well, this is what happened to me, not from a blame perspective, not to say, oh, this happened, poor me, that's why I struggle, it's their fault. That is not what I'm talking about. That is blame. That gets nobody anywhere. That does not help at all. But explaining, to say, this is how I was treated. This is what happened to me. This is how it affected me. This is how it affected my sense of self, my feeling in, about myself, my feeling with other people, my feeling in the world. And I want to recognize that and work through it. I'll get to how you work through it in a moment. In the service of healing it and changing it. So first is, hey, I want to really look at this not from a victim perspective, but from a place of interest and be really curious about how you came to feel this certain way. And then healing involves going through a mourning process, not for just for what happened, but for what didn't happen. If you had a Dickensian childhood, and Dickensian meaning like out of a Dickens novel, terrible things happen, awful, awful things happen constantly, then people interpret that often as this happened because there's something wrong with me. Kids do not have the wherewithal to say, what's wrong with my parents that they're treating me this way? What's the deal? Or, oh, they're going through a lot and they don't know how to handle stuff. Parents say, do what they do. And kids say, they're doing this to me because there must be something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. I'm too much. There must be something wrong with me. I'm bad. So first step is to go, well, how were you treated and how did you interpret it? And then go through the mourning process of what it was like to go through the difficult times that you went through while recognizing how it affected you. And that means, so the stages of grief with death, and it applies to all kinds of grieving, I believe, are denial. It didn't affect me. Nah, I'm stronger for it. It had no bearing on me other than I'm a better, stronger person in the world. That's usually total denial. Partially true, but denying the pain. Then anger. Oh my God, this really happened to me. This happened to me. I can't believe this happened to me. This is wrong. I was an innocent child, or, you know, however old you were, this happened to me. It is wrong. It was unfair. It was painful. I'm outraged. I'm angry. I'm so frustrated and upset that this happened to me, and really processing it, not just thinking it. A lot of people think that they're expressing their feelings when really they're just identifying their feelings. So identifying your anger is, oh, I realize I was really very angry about that. Yep, very outraged, very angry. That's identifying it, right? Feeling it is, oh my God, I'm so upset. Right? Feeling is different from thinking. And then the stage is bargaining. Well, maybe if I do this, I'll feel differently. Or maybe if I do that, they'll treat me differently. Or maybe if I just, right, bargaining. The if, then. When, then. And eventually you've got to give that up. And then you get sad. You get depressed. Ugh. This happened to me. This is sad. This is how it's affected me. All this time that it's affected me, how sad. This is painful. And then that, by going through that, that leads to acceptance. That's when you have the scar. Yes, it happened, but it doesn't affect me anymore. It doesn't affect me the way it has. And then you also do the same process for what didn't happen. The family you didn't get, the relationships you didn't get, the love, the acceptance, the sense of well-being that you didn't get to have. You also have to acknowledge and and recognize and mourn what you didn't get to have. So I hope that answers your question. Josh is saying when a parent treats us badly, we feel despair. Yes, we feel despair, and we also often feel as if we're bad. Oh, we're being treated badly. We must be bad, or we must be not good enough. Back to the not good enough. Now, think of someone you compare yourself to. What do you imagine would happen if you had her or his looks, weight, finances, life? What do you imagine would change if you were that person? And then ask yourself, what? I'm so glad that I'm answering. I'm not going to Aeolali. Oh, I can't pronounce names. I am so sorry, but I'm really glad that that helped. Then think about something you feel good about yourself. Think about what you feel good about physically. And before you say, oh, I hate everything physical about me. No, look in the mirror, find something about yourself that you like. You will find something about yourself that you like. Focus on it. Focus on what you like about yourself, because if we only look at what we don't like, we never see what we do like. I always start my coaching programs, my group coaching programs, including the one I do with Kelly Gunter, who is the author of You Have Such a Pretty Face, great book, with wins. We talk about what are the wins you had during the week, so that we can start focusing on, well, what did you do right? And at first, no one can do it. I don't know. I didn't do anything right. Nothing good happened. And then if you think about it, you start recognizing, no, I did this differently. And I took this step and I actually like that I did that. The more you practice focusing on what you like about yourself, what you look like, so physically, emotionally, and mentally, what do you feel good about? Relationally, when you start focusing on that, you will discover things you like and feel better about you. Remember, the number on the scale does not define you. It is just a measure of your weight. It does not measure you as a person. And that's why you're not a better person if you're thinner, and you're not a worse person if you're heavier. Keep in mind that the size of your kindness, your generosity, your intelligence, your compassion, all of those things, that is a far better measure of you as a person. Just one thing, Josh, I just want to finish up and then I will get to you. I see you're waiting. Hold on. If other people do not get past the number on the scale, then you've got their number, so to speak, and you can delete it. Ha! So pleased with myself. Okay. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Dr. Nina. Hopefully you had a really good week. I really appreciate just being able to talk to you. And I just wanted to report that I'm doing really well. I've stayed true to my feelings. And as a result of that, I haven't needed as much food as I was eating, which is great.
That's wonderful. And it sounds like you're really much more attuned to yourself, because when we're thinking about food or we're eating food, we're not with ourselves. And it sounds like you're much more able to be with yourself. What are you noticing?
Well, I'm noticing when people don't behave the way I would expect them to, that's the worst thing. And then what happens from that is they start to eat at me. And then if I'm not conscious of it, which is very painful to be conscious of, because we live in a, you know, society where we all have to live together and we share certain things and we have to cooperate. So the pain of having people not behave the way you expect them to is what is eating at me.
Pain, disappointment. And then what comes to mind about that specifically? Like, you know, sometimes in we have experiences in the present, but it really is just a re-experiencing of something from the past.
Yes. So it had to do with my parents growing up, and they may have not behaved the way I wanted them to all the time. And it's the same exact feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you say they might have not behaved the way you wanted to, can you be more specific?
Yeah, I think my father was, you know, a little probably, you know, not so accommodating. I sort of took the side of my mother. And in that case, it was difficult because my father would not really, he's a Republican and he sort of, you know, he voted for Trump, and I don't want to make it political, but it certainly wasn't too good to be brought up in that kind of environment, because the child should be allowed to be, you know, should be allowed to feel. Even a male child should be allowed to feel emotion.
Interesting. Even a male child. Yes. All people, whatever their gender, male, female, non-binary, you know, have emotions, and we need to be able to recognize them and then learn to soothe them. We'll learn to express them and soothe them. And if you're not allowed to have your feelings, or you're only allowed to have certain feelings, then you don't know how to express them and feel them, and you don't know how to soothe them. And that's what food does. And that's why food is the solution, not the problem.
I think, you know, I always compare myself to you, and, you know, not being able to feel emotions means I needed to have food to fill that void. And I think what you've shared from your experience is you weren't actually allowed to have food itself. But it's not any different for me, because by not allowing to be able to have emotions, it did eventually lead to a food issue.
And then the emotions that you're not allowed to have about other people can come back at you. So let's say you're mad at your dad, the Republican Trumper, you're mad at him, but you're not allowed really to be mad at him, or you can't have a discussion with him, or you can't express yourself. So then you go eat whatever, and then you're mad at yourself for eating. Therefore, you've taken the feelings that belong towards about someone else and attacked yourself.
Yeah. I mean, they have to go somewhere, because children don't have appropriate affect regulation.
Children have feelings. Children have feelings, and everything feels really intense when you're a kid, right? We have to learn to gauge and regulate our feelings. But if we don't learn to gauge and regulate our feelings, and by that, it's like on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, like let's take anger. Rage is a 10. Annoyance is a 2 or a 3. But if you're never allowed to feel any form of anger, then any feeling, then an annoyance can feel like a 10. And then it's too much. And we're walking around always feeling like any feeling is too much, and are afraid to feel them at all. But except for stuffing the feelings, eating the feelings, and then getting mad at ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, when we can't feel feelings, or when we can't actually eat food, we're going to feel some despair, because even though you may not be able to feel feelings, you might be still alive. If you're not able to eat food, you can die.
Well, yes, but Josh, what we're really saying is if you don't learn to be with your internal world in a way that is compassionate and accepting and loving and comforting, you're going to either turn to or from food to express something inside. You might starve. Some people starve themselves to so that the emptiness and loneliness they feel is felt in their bodies. Some people stuff a lot of food in to symbolically fill a void. You want to, for yourself, look at what's going on in terms of your thoughts and your emotions, and how can you respond to yourself the best way that you can?
Yeah. You know, it's something that you, I think you said this about Christopher Bola, it's mindset in mind. And I think there's so, we always talk about one thing, anger or this or that, but there, in reality, there's so many things, so many competing feelings and ideas. Most of it is completely at odds with each other. So to start with, I think we have to get over the fear of the complexity of our own mind and try to do what we can.
Okay. And Josh, I challenge you to talk about less we and more I.
In my case, it would be feeling despair. Because when, let's say a child is feeling sad, just normal sadness, what child hasn't felt sad? If that child, meaning me, wasn't allowed to feel sadness, that sadness turns into hopelessness very quickly.
Yes, yes. It goes from sadness to despair. And
yeah.
And if you are, and Regan, I see your question in the thread. I'm going to get to it as soon as Josh and I are done with this important conversation, Josh, because there, in, if you don't feel a little sad, you're going to go to despair. And if you feel sad and no one is there to comfort you, it's like if you're sad and someone comes and hugs you and says, oh, yeah, you're sad. Of course you're sad. How could you not be sad, right? This is my very technique. How could you not be sad? Anyone in this situation would feel sad. Here's a hug. It's okay. You're going to feel better. You're going to get through this, right? Then feeling sad is not so scary. But when you feel sad and you're shamed for it, when you're dismissed, when you're ignored, when you're neglected, then feeling sad is devastating and does turn into despair. And that's why showing up for yourself and being available to yourself to validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself, that's what makes you feel better. That's responding to yourself. And when you respond to yourself, you don't need to react. Reacting is, oh, this is a bad feeling that's coming on. What's in the pantry?
Yeah, or anger.
Or anger. Or anything, right? Or anything.
Yeah.
You'll do the same thing. It's the same formula, if you will. Of course I'm mad. Of course I'm furious. How could I not be? This is the situation. It's enraging. Ugh, so pissed.
But what happens when you...
And then...
What happens when you get angry is you forget the original thing that was causing you to feel slightly sad.
Yes. Well, what you're talking about is a phenomenon that happens. It's a gender phenomenon often, but not always. Whereas guys who are socialized not to feel sadness, they're socialized to feel anger. Anger is acceptable.
Exactly.
Sadness is not. And so a lot of times guys, instead of feeling sad, because that's, you know, no, guys don't, boys don't cry. They go right to anger. And then girls also are socialized not to be angry. And so sometimes when they're angry, they go right to sadness. So it can be a little
tricky.
Isn't
that interesting? That's really interesting.
And how you know if that's what's happening is like if sometimes you cry and sometimes you express anger, then you can be pretty clear that you're responding to the appropriate feeling to the situation. But if you never cry and you're always mad, or you're never mad and you're always sad, then that's something to really look at.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting is, how do we respond to the despair? What is our original, what's our initial response? Do we just dig our heels in more? Do we start to, you know, feel that we have to be better than the other person? Do we start to unconsciously compete? You know, these are the kind of things that we should be aware of, because every one of us is going to feel despair at some time in our life.
Well, Josh, I notice a lot of times you go to us and we and not me. So I'm going to say to you, how you respond to despair is the same way you respond to any other experience. You validate, you give it expression to it. I know you have my book, The Binge Cure. Go to page 45 and 46 and 47. There are prompts for sadness, for anger, for loneliness, for different emotions. Finish the sentence. Finish the prompts. So first, express it. Secondly, respond to yourself. And that's the very. Validate it. Acknowledge it. And reassure yourself.
Yeah, I think that's great. You know, I've been thinking about sort of despair, and I think Kierkegaard wrote about despair, and it's something that should be cherished. It's something that should be, we should be interested in our despair. We should be interested, if we can, in the despair of others. I mean, I think that's what makes us compassionate, sane people.
Well, and that's more of a philosophical discussion, we can feel despair if we can also, now I'm doing it, the generalizing, if we can feel joy and despair, that's the human condition. If we always feel despair, that is emotional dysregulation. As you put it, that's being in a bad place. And then we feel stuck in that. Food's the thing that gets us out of it. Then we're in a toxic relationship with ourselves. So I encourage you to practice expressing your feelings, and then validating, acknowledging, reassuring, responding to them. And let's see what comes up.
That sounds good. Thank you very much, Dr. Nina.
You're welcome, Josh. Thank you, as always, for elevating the conversation.
My pleasure. Talk to you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, so Regan is writing an Instagram. I'm in the binge free babes. When we started doing the wins, I didn't get it. Then I got it. And I struggled saying the wins aloud. Now I get it. I'm on board, but I am struggling with the good, saying the good out loud and feeling the good. How do I keep going? Well, hi, Regan. I'm glad you're here. And that is a great question, because so often we can be afraid of the good. We want it desperately, and yet we have some negative associations. Oh, I'm not good enough to deserve this good. I don't really deserve this good. Someone, if I let myself have it, the universe is going to realize it made a mistake, and then they're going to take it away from me. Or who am I to think well of myself, right? This idea that having a positive self-esteem somehow makes you an arrogant person. Those are things that can also be at play. So Regan, and anyone who could relate to her question, you know, how do you stay with the good? You listen to the part, the voice within that tells you why you shouldn't be feeling it. So is it fear? You know, break down that uncomfortable feeling and turn it more into a dialogue. Is there a part of your mind saying, you don't deserve this? Is there a you, by the way, second person voice at work here? Is there a voice going, you don't deserve to feel good? Who do you think you are feeling good? That's not for you. Bad things happen to you. You're tempting the universe, right? So Regan, I don't know if you're still there. If you are, feel free to post. But with any change, right? With any change, practice makes progress. It's hard to change, even when the change is positive. We go for the familiar, but we have to look at, well, you know, what makes it feel safe? What makes a negative, painful situation feel safe? Because it's familiar, but also because we got messages that some part of us believes. Remember, it's not logical, it's psychological. So if some part of you believes, hey, I deserve good things, logical. I'm a good person. I know Regan is a good person. I'm a good person. I'm creative and talented, and I believe in good. I believe that I deserve to feel good, right? And Regan, feel free to join in. But another part of your mind says, not so fast. You don't deserve, like, don't step on that rug of happiness, because someone is going to pull it out from underneath you, because you don't really deserve that. You're supposed to suffer. Well, if you have these ideas, whether you're conscious of them or they're operating out of your awareness, unconscious means basically something is out of your awareness, but it is not out of operation. It is out of your awareness, but it has so much power over how you think and what you do. But you're not even aware of it. That's what makes it, like, the unconscious mind is so interesting and so vexing, because it has so much power. Regan is saying she listens to the familiar voice way too much. Whose voice is that? So if you have trouble holding the good, and the familiar voice is saying, this is not for you, well, either that's your voice based on an interpretation of what happened to you, or it's someone else's voice saying, oh, that's not for you. You know, I've shared that, you know, people have been told, you've climbed so far, it's going to be quite a fall, when, you know, as if they can't, I mean, family members have told them. This one person, her mother said, oh, well, I knew you were bound for a crash, because you had climbed so high. Of course you were going to fall down. And so it's not, so, okay. So the voice is her dad's, right? So your dad's voice is saying, no, that's not for you. Yeah. I mean, that's very painful. And like it or not, when we're kids, our parents are the first gods, right? If everyone loves you, but your parents are, like, nasty to you, or they find fault with you, or they criticize you, who are you going to believe? All the people who love you, or your parents who are supposed to know you the best? Our parents are the first gods. And if our parents, for whatever reason, are not able to be there for us, be loving, be nurturing, support us, then, you know, we think we don't deserve support. We think we're not good enough. Again, back to that. And then we grow up thinking we're not good enough. Back to the topic I started with. We come to believe we're not good enough based on an interpretation we make about ourselves, which is by how other people treat us. Kids do not have the wherewithal to say, you know, for example, my mom is and this is not me talking, this is, I'm an imaginary person, right? Going, my mom and dad, they're alcoholics. And because they can't deal with their own stuff, they're diving into a bottle every night, and that's why they're neglecting me. And this is really hard, and I feel so powerless. Kids do not say that. Kids think, what's wrong with me that they'd rather drink until they get into oblivion than spend time with me? What's wrong with me? And when you're a child, this actually gives you some hope. Gives you some hope. Because if you can figure out what's wrong with you and make yourself better, then the fantasy is, the illusion is, oh, then they're going to be nice to me. Then they'll stop drinking themselves into oblivion. Then they'll hang out with me. If I can just figure out what's wrong with me and make myself right, then I'm going to get totally different treatment. Except this is an illusion. And there's never anything wrong with you. There's something wrong with the way you're being treated. And if you don't see that and you really think, well, something's wrong with me, then you become an adult who just has this sense of, I'm not quite good enough, or I'm too much. And that those often go together. I'm not good enough and I'm too much. And so challenging these ideas, they go back to childhood. This is why I say the past is not in the past. The past is in our present. If you don't feel good enough in your present, I guarantee you, it's because something happened in the past that made you decide and come to believe that you're not good enough. And we got to have one foot in the present and one foot in the past. I like to pretend to get in my DeLorean time machine because I love Back to the Future so much. go into the DeLorean time machine, go back in time, talk to your younger self from a place of understanding now what happened. It wasn't that you weren't good enough. It was that your parents didn't know how to cope. And that's why they drank. Or they didn't know how to relate to other people. And that's why they never played with you or really engaged with you. Or they didn't know how to be with themselves. How could they be with you in a meaningful way? When you heal the wounds of the past, the present is transformed. And where does food come into it? If you never learn to comfort yourself, if you never learn to reassure yourself, if you never learn to encourage yourself, you just feel terrible all the time. Food makes you feel better. Food also helps you express your pain, right? If you eat so much that you're in pain, and when I was full on in all my eating disorders, I remember doing that. I remember just being in complete pain. And yet I couldn't stop. And looking back, I now realize I was completely translating my emotional pain into physical pain. Once I dealt with the emotional pain, things with food completely normalized. I went from being the poster child of eating disorders to not having any eating disorder thoughts at all. That's why I'm telling you, based on 20 years of experience, as a psychoanalyst and a coach, exclusively treating eating disorders, having had eating disorders from when I was, five to college, I know there is hope. That's why I don't believe in recovery. Recovery is you're in it. I'm in recovery. Who wants to be in recovery? No, I am here to tell you that when you deal with what's eating at you and you heal, you are liberated. Liberation means you won. You won the diet war. You won the war. You're done. You're victorious. You don't have to fight anymore. That's liberation. It means you don't think about it at all. And you can go have breakfast, lunch, and dinner and snacks and just think about, what do I want? And not have it be an obsession, a preoccupation. You can lose weight without dieting, get to a healthy, normal weight. That's liberation. It is possible. I am passionate about this idea. And as you can probably tell, so excited about changing the dialogue in our world, in our society, which we can do. So I want to thank everyone who participated today. I want to thank Josh and Regan and everyone else examined life. And oh gosh, I don't know how to say, I'm going to call you Layla, because I can say the last part of your Instagram name, but thank you all for joining in the conversation today. Because when you bring up something, I know that there are thousands of other people out there who can absolutely relate to what you're saying. We are all much more alike than we realize. We live in a society that tells us not to feel things, not to want too much. So what do we do when we feel things and we want things? What do we do when we don't feel good enough? Ayo. Okay. I'll call you Ayo. Thank you. Laylee. I also can't really see the name very well. So I need to have my glasses, which I don't have, but thank you everyone for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show. By helping yourself, you also help other people. We're changing the conversation. We're changing the world, really. I am here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio and Instagram. You can also listen later on Apple Podcasts. Just look for the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And again, if you like the show, please give a rating or a review, because the more ratings and reviews we get, the more it shows up in searches and the more people we can reach and help. So have a wonderful week. And I have a great guest on next week, Dr. Maggie Landes. You're going to love her. I will see you then. See you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.